Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. Today on Brussels Sprouts, we're trying out something new. This is our first podcast that Jim and I are doing over the phone. And we are continuing a series of discussions we've been having on populism and threats to democracy in Europe. We've talked to Larry Diamond, we've talked to Cass Mood. And today on the line, we have the great pleasure to talk with Sherry Berman. And for those of you who don't know Sherry, she is a professor of political science at Barnard College at Columbia University. And she's just recently put out a fantastic book, Democracy and Dictatorship in Europe, From the Ancien Regime to the Present Day. It is, as I said, fantastic and very substantial history of democracy in Europe. And so, Sherry, thanks for joining us on this hot summer day.
I'm happy to be here.
So I always struggle to figure out where to start these conversations because I feel like we could go in so many different directions. But maybe just to start from the very beginning, it would be fantastic to hear how you think about the current challenges with democracy today. Kind of where are we? How do you think about and characterize the current state of affairs?
Okay, that's great. So I understand from what you just said, of course, that you've recently spoken to Larry Diamond and Cass Mood. So you've obviously had some folks on already who have given you sort of their perspective on the state of democracy today. So maybe partially just to give a slightly different perspective to the folks who listen to your podcast, let me say something slightly more optimistic than I'm guessing they said. So there's a lot of talk today about, you know, sort of democratic backsliding and democratic decay. And that is certainly something to be concerned about. But as a person who, as you mentioned, has just written a book on sort of the history of democracy from the early modern period in Europe up to the present day, my perspective might be somewhat different than that of someone who focuses primarily on the contemporary period. So why is that relevant? Well, first of all, we still remain today, as far as empirics go, with the largest number of democracies we've really ever had. So we have many, many more democracies than we've had 10 years ago, 20 years ago, certainly a generation ago. And so the number of democracies is quite high. So that's an important thing to remember. Second is that when social scientists kind of look at democracy, they often use the term waves to kind of discuss the ways in which democracies develop. So waves with a W-A-V-E-S, the kind of thing that we all go to the beach to enjoy. And why do they use that term? Well, because what tends to happen if you look back over time, is that democracies tend to develop in clumps. There are times in history when many, many countries transition to democracy. And, you know, the most recent version of that, the most actually momentous version of that was after 1989, right, with the collapse of the Soviet Union. We had transitions not only in, you know, Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Union, but we also had transitions around the same time in Latin America, in Africa. So this is a time when we had a huge number of countries making transitions to democracy. Previous waves of democracy included after the Second World War, after the First World War, 1848. So first reason why they use the term waves is that we tend to see these periods when lots of countries move politically in unison. But we also use the term waves because, like anybody who's gone to the beach knows, waves have undertows. So every time you have a wave, there's backsliding. And so if you were to look at any other previous period when you saw lots of countries make transitions to democracy, the undertow was much greater than what we had today. And the reason why there are undertows is because during these periods of democratic progress, many countries make transitions to democracy that don't have what it takes normatively, institutionally, to make democracy work. So undertows are inevitable, just like they are in real waves, because a lot of these transitions don't have what it takes to make democracy work. And we can talk more about that. Now, you've seen an undertow and the wave that began at the end of the 20th century. That's what people are so concerned about today. But that undertow has been much less strong than previous undertows. So we should be concerned about countries that are backsliding, but we should recognize that this is not unusual. What is unusual today, and I'm guessing you've discussed this previously, is that we are beginning to see decay, significant decay, in countries where we thought democracy was taken for granted, consolidated, fully fledged, places like the United States and Western Europe. That is somewhat unusual. To see countries that have been democracies, well-functioning democracies for a substantial period of time, undergoing democratic decay is unusual. So looking at the sort of broad trends of the contemporary period, the backsliding that has occurred in countries that are making first transitions to democracy, places like Hungary, Poland, in Eastern Europe, places with very limited democratic experience, Turkey, Russia, those things we should be concerned about but not surprised about. But democratic backsliding in places like the United States and Western Europe, that is something more historically unusual, and therefore I think what we should really be focusing our attention on.
The waves metaphor is a very good one, and as you mentioned, you know, there's waves, and then there have been historically reverse waves. And I think you hear people equate the present time very often to the 1930s, and people will say things like, this is the most trying time for democracy since the 1930s. And what do you think is the utility or the limits of that analogy? So you mentioned, obviously, that now, you know, that the undertow is less significant than it has been in these previous periods. So what do you think we should take away from that past period, the 1930s analogy, and what are the limits of that?
So that's a great question. I mean, historical analogies can be very helpful because, you know, they give us something to compare to learn from, and that kind of thing. But they can be dangerous if they are applied too broadly or acontextually. So to say, again, that this is the worst period for democracy since the 1930s, I think that is a gross exaggeration. As I said, the amount of backsliding that we've had in the late 20th and early 20th century is much, much less than any previous wave, number one. So number two, if we are even just focused just on Europe, right? One interesting thing to note, an important thing to note, is while there was an incredible amount of democratic backsliding during the interwar years, right? Again, as I already mentioned, there's a huge number of transitions that occur after the First World War to democracy. But by the end of the 1930s, many of these countries had already shifted back to dictatorship, right? Germany and Italy being the most important, but all of the East European countries that were formed out of the collapse of the Habsburg Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the German Empire, all of those countries also, with the exception of Czechoslovakia, slid back into dictatorship on their own. But here's the key thing that's important to note. None of the countries that slid back into democracy during the interwar years had a significant history of either democracy or liberalism before the First World War. That is to say that the countries that slid back during the interwar period were those, as I mentioned previously, with very little history of either liberalism or democracy. So again, mixed up in the numbers, right, again, just like today, are some important underlying trends that are important to understand, not only because we want to really figure out, okay, look, what's actually going on, but because they give us some insights into causally what's causing the problems. And again, the countries that backslid during the interwar years were not countries that had already had significant experience with liberalism and democracy during the interwar years. They were the countries that had made transitions recently without a lot of experience with, again, the kinds of norms and institutions that are necessary to make democracy work. So yes, there are some things to note that are similar to the interwar period, but important things that are different as well. And the other part of the interwar analogy that people spend a lot of time talking about is obviously fascism and National Socialism, and its overlaps with similarities, differences to contemporary populism. You've probably talked about that a lot. As a person who spent a lot of time studying that, I would suggest using the terms fascism and National Socialism advisedly. These were very particular type of movements, not to say that populism is, you know, not dangerous, it's not a threat to democracy, but it is different in significant ways from the fascist and National Socialist movements that helped to topple many democratic regimes during the interwar period.
That's really helpful. I want to ask one more kind of backward-looking question before we kind of fast forward up to the contemporary time. And that you were mentioning kind of all of the countries that backslid in this previous wave were countries without a history of liberalism or democracy. And I think we're hearing a lot of discussion now actually about the relationship between liberalism and democracy. So people talk about liberal democracy. But as you note in your book, that liberal democracy really has been the exception rather than the norm. And historically speaking, it's been much more of a history of illiberal democracy. So could you just give us a brief kind of description, definition of the relationship? What's the difference between liberalism and democracy, and how have those two developed over time?
Great. Yeah. I mean, again, the advantage of a historical perspective is it does give you many more cases to examine, and it gives you a sense of how different kinds of systems develop over time. So we've come during the post-war period in the second half of the 20th century to take liberal democracy in the West for granted. We kind of assume not only that that's the system we have, but we assume that those two things to go together. But that's actually only been the norm, even in the West, since the Second World War. So before the Second World War, in Europe in particular, you did not have liberal democracy as the norm. The number of actually liberal democracies you had in Western Europe, as again, I'm going to put Eastern Europe aside because those places had democracy for only a very short period in the interwar years before they collapsed back into dictatorships. Very, very few of those. Now, that doesn't mean you didn't have lots of democratic experiments. Starting with the French Revolution, you had transitions to democracy in Europe throughout the 19th and early 20th century. But very few of those, again, very, very few, were liberal democracies. Okay, so what does that mean? So democracy is about elections. It's about majority rule. It's about what political scientists term free and fair elections. That is to say, elections where there's more than one party competing, where you have some of the protections that are necessary to make sure that that election and that political competition is actually meaningful. So some degree of freedom of the press, some degree of freedom of organizing, that kind of thing. Liberalism is something very different. Liberalism actually is about limiting rule of the majority, right? It's about rule of law, which says you can and cannot do certain kinds of things. It's about individual rights, which says the government can't do this, right? Think about our Bill of Rights. It's all about things the government can't do or can't take away. It's about minority rights. It's about protecting certain groups from things that the majority might do. So liberalism is about constraining power. Democracy is about giving power to the people. And actually, when you think about it, it's much easier in a way to kind of sell people on the idea of self-rule, that is to say that they should have the right to rule themselves, than it is to sell them on liberalism, which is about, again, restraining the power of the majority. It's about saying that governments, even ones that are elected in free and fair elections, can't do certain kinds of things. And so convincing, for example, European publics of the advantages of liberalism, of restraining power, that was actually a much harder sell. And like I said, really only became the norm after 1945 in Western Europe. So when we talk about illiberal democracies, we're talking about democracies where there's still elections that are somewhat free and fair, but where the other things, consistent rule of law, protection of individual rights, protection of minority rights, those things have been chipped away or eviscerated entirely. And so if you were to go back and kind of count up the regimes that existed in Europe and other parts of the world before 1945, of the democracies that did exist, most of them, in fact, almost all of them would have been illiberal rather than liberal democracies.
And I think that, you know, that's a good transition to, I think, what we're seeing today with the growth in popularity of populism, which is not inherently anti-democratic, but it is illiberal. And I have heard you, Sherry, give a masterful kind of synthesis of what you think is driving contemporary populism in Europe. And so I wonder if you wouldn't mind just doing a really broad or a very brief rundown of those broad drivers of populism in Europe today.
Sure. So, I mean, when scholars and observers look at populism, they tend to kind of approach its underlying causes from two different perspectives. The first perspective is what political scientists call the demand side, that is to say the kinds of things that have been happening that have caused people, citizens, voters, to demand political change, to be willing to vote for populism, things like that. And those kinds of explanations fall into two or maybe three categories. One is economic. We all know that one. The idea here is that economic changes have, you know, increased inequality, diminished social mobility, increased geographic and social divides, made people angry, made people resentful. And, you know, that's why they're kind of voting for populists. The sort of second demand side explanation is one that focuses, instead of economic, on social and cultural trends. Here, people will talk about things like changing demographics, rising immigration, both in Europe and the U.S. In the United States, alongside rising immigration, which, again, it should be noted, really is at historic levels in both the United States and much of Western Europe. In the United States, of course, also the mobilization of minority groups. These things are seen to have upset status hierarchies in these countries, made white folks in particular, especially those without education, worry about their position in society, feel uncomfortable. And, you know, they vote for populists who promise to kind of restore the, you know, sort of pre-demographic social change status quo. Sometimes you'll see technological change thrown into that mix. That is to say, the argument that social media and the way we communicate has also kind of contributed to, you know, a sort of populist tendencies. The other side is the supply side. And here what folks look at really is what's been going on with our political institutions. And there's a lot of discussion of this both in the United States and Europe, the idea that our politicians and our parties and our governments have become less responsive. There's lots of evidence in the United States for, you know, parties and politicians becoming more responsive to ever smaller sectors of the population, and this making people feel angry and therefore willing to vote for parties or support movements who are outside the system. In Europe, political parties, traditional political parties, have really collapsed. Membership levels have collapsed. Parties' attachments to civil society organizations have collapsed. And so the way in which citizens were kind of linked to the political system in the past has really diminished, again, leaving many people feel like they don't have a lot of connection to the system and it's not responsive to them. In Europe, of course, people spend a lot of time talking about the impact of the EU, the fact that the European Union has taken away lots of powers, particularly over economic policy, and to some degree over immigration, from national governments. And this has, again, made people feel like their national level political institutions are not responsive to their demands. And so from that perspective, that supply side perspective, populism is really a result of the fact that people feel they no longer have a voice, right? That their political institutions, politicians, parties, governments are not really responsive to them. They're responsive to whatever, minorities or elites or, you know, European Union bureaucrats or something like that. So I think all of those things are probably playing into it, and that's why we've seen populism recently, precisely because there are all of these kind of disconcerting and troubling trends that have kind of come together at the beginning of the 21st century and really made not only a lot of people feel uncomfortable and unsure about the future, but also made our political institutions actually less able to deal with some of the real challenges that our societies face.
That's all been very, very interesting. It's quite an education, and I appreciate it. And I think all of the Brussels Sprouts listeners are going to have a lot to take away from this. But let me ask you, as a practitioner, I'm speaking about myself here. So what do you do? You know, I think in the past, and the history you laid out was very interesting and very helpful too. In the past, I wonder if they were as taken as a lot in the West are now, in the EU or at NATO sometimes, but in capitals as well in the West, that we have to do something about backsliding. For instance, in the Obama administration, we wanted to punish Hungary. So the Hungarian, Hungarian officials, they couldn't see anyone but me at the Pentagon when they came over to Washington, and because, you know, we just weren't going to deal with that Hungarian government because they were backsliding. Poland had similar problems. The EU has done sanctions. And so I think, and you know better than I, but it seems that right now what is kind of new about watching these waves and the backsliding and the undertow is that there's a feeling among in some capitals and in the institutions that we need to do something, we need to punish, we need to bring about change. And there's not many useful tools to do that. The EU has sanctions. People talk about kicking nations out of NATO. There's no provision for that. And having been a practitioner for a long time, getting nations to do something they don't want to do is very difficult. So in the past, we've kind of sat back and said, well, maybe what we do, we just wait it out. Mečiar, you know, in Slovakia and others, you kind of wait it out for the politics to change, and then you're back on track. Is that the only thing that really works, or do you think we've got to develop tools and the institutions need to play a bigger role in holding back this kind of backsliding?
So that's a great question, because obviously understanding what's going on today is the first step in trying to figure out what one can do about it. And I think that there's kind of two things to note in that regard. First is, yes, of course, you know, countries' political fates are, for the most part, with exceptions, you know, sort of wars and the end of wars when outside actors can really have a huge impact. Countries' fates are primarily in their own hands. You know, whether countries develop successfully into consolidated liberal democracies has more to do with, you know, things that are going on within those countries than things outside actors can do. That said, outside actors can play an important role. And in particular, you know, what we've seen over the last decade or so with the United States and Europe, I think is an incredibly good illustration of that. I mean, the European Union might have been the most important promoter of democracy that has ever existed, right? Perhaps with the, you know, exception of the United States. I mean, the European Union played a huge role both in enticing the Southern European countries to make those transitions, right, providing incentives for them to do so, training domestic actors in democratic practices, and then ushering them through their transitions. And obviously, that is true, albeit in a different way, for the East Europeans. I mean, the desire to join Europe, to be normal, to share in what was then a prosperous, peaceful union was an incredible draw, right? And that was really, really important. And of course, the United States, both through its efforts and through being an exemplar, right? You want to be like the most powerful country in the world, right? Exerted a huge attraction on transitioning countries. And also, again, as you mentioned, by shunning, right, or making clear that we did not accept certain kinds of, you know, things involved with democratic backsliding. Could we entirely reverse those processes? No, but we could make the incentive structure change, and we could also signal to people around the world, hey, look, you know, if you want a good relationship with us, right, unless you have a lot of oil or something else we really want, in which case, you know, we'll do whatever, you better play by the democratic rules of the game. And what's happened basically over the last 10 years is both the United States and Europe have been unable to really act as not only the attractive force of democracy, but actually an umpire that says, look, you're no longer playing by the rules of the game, and so you're going to have to pay a price for that. The European Union, again, both because it did not, for some reason or another, consider what it would do with countries that backslid, despite the fact that being a liberal capitalist democracy was the condition for joining, right? There was no clear provisions made for how to deal with countries that no longer fit into that category, along with other problems, right? The unwillingness of the European People's Party, for instance, to sanction Orban. So the European Union really did not act as an umpire, you know, in the way that it should have with countries like Poland and Hungary. And the United States, under the Trump administration, has absolutely no interest not only in sanctioning countries that are backsliding, but seems to, in fact, revel in, you know, sort of promoting leaders who clearly are not interested in liberal democracy at all. So again, while trends in places like Hungary and Poland and Russia and Turkey are primarily driven by domestic level factors, the inability or unwillingness of the United States or Europe to actually force these leaders to pay a greater price and to provide an attractive sort of poll for democratic activists in these countries has absolutely, I think, accelerated these negative trends in many parts of the world today.
Well, I agree with that your last statement. In fact, as you described what we used to do, and the Brits, and I guess the West, if you will, I mean, back in the past number of decades, there was this idea that we were an umpire, if you will, or the moral standard, or as Reagan said, you know, the shining city on the hill and all this type of thing. People wanted to be like us, and we provided incentives with NATO enlargement. You know, if you did this and this and this and this, you had you know, market economy, good relations with neighbors. This is how you get into NATO. And so there was this flourishing over the past, particularly after the Cold War ended, I think, for lots of different reasons. But also during the Cold War, we were this, you know, what a lot of the movements aspired to be like is the United States, and they, and solidarity and others moved towards that end. But I'm wondering if we're kind of, that's no longer the case anymore. The idea that the West, that the EU, that NATO, that the United States particularly, that we would police up this community that we had created after World War II, and that the nations of Europe would all play a role in this, the Brits, the French, West Europe particularly, and that we were all willing to do that, and we all, you know, embraced that as a responsibility, that's gone now. I mean, not just because of Trump, but I think Trump certainly unlocked a lot of feeling in the country that they didn't see the U.S. in this role, that we weren't not just the, we weren't the policeman, but we weren't the hall monitor of the world either. And so this idea that why should we tell other nations what to do? Seems to be kind of coming to the fore. And so, you know, as you think about post-Trump, I wonder if a U.S. government coming after him is going to go back to those 1990s or during the Cold War days, go back to that kind of time when we were the hall monitor, or is that over with and we're kind of going to be in a bit of a free fall?
Well, look, I mean, I'm not a great fortune teller, but I will say this. You know, up until fairly recently, in my lifetime anyway, the general consensus was that the United States stood for certain ideals, that we weren't, you know, again, a racial or ethnic community. What we were was a country that was built on certain ideals. Now, that's been a pretty strong constant throughout American history. The debate has really been about, you know, what do we do about those ideals as far as the rest of the world is concerned? There definitely seems, of course, they're definitely predating Trump, especially after the Iraq War, was growing again, I think, discontent with the idea that the United States should go out and, you know, impose democracy on other countries, right? Obviously,
George W.
you know,
Bush.
That is something that took a huge hit in the Iraq War, although that wasn't obviously the main reason we went there. And so, yes, that has waxed and waned throughout American history, how sort of actively we should pursue this. But the idea that we should not act as an example, and that we should not, without, again, you know, military or other kind of intervention, make clear that we think that democracy is a good thing, that everybody deserves to rule over themselves, that dictatorships are wrong. Those are things that really have not been questioned previously in American history. Again, with the exception of the fact that, you know, sort of international relations requires a certain degree of realism, and the United States has always dealt with, you know, dictators when it seemed to be primarily in their self-interest. But the idea that we would be indifferent to the fate of democracy, that's not actually something that has been fairly constant or a norm in American history. And so for the U.S. to pull back from that, again, that would be a significant change, and I think would continue to encourage those around the globe who are interested in rolling back democracy in their own country.
But I think if you mentioned the U.S. stepping away from that, I think there's another point too here where the events over the past couple of days, if not past couple of years, have made our voice a very weak one. When we stand up for things and we tell the Hungarians or others, that's a very, you know, that's an unacceptable thing for a liberal democracy to do, and they turn around and say, well, why don't you go talk to the people of North Carolina who are saying send her back. But anyway, let me pass it over to Andrea.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more about the comments of, you know, the United States' role in how the international environment shapes democratic trajectories of countries. But I do, just to turn back really to your expertise, Sherry, just to talk about some of the need for institutional reform from within democracy. So how do we revitalize from within? And one of the things that you've written quite a lot about is what's happening to political parties, particularly the center left and social democracy. And so obviously in parallel or in conjunction with the rise of populism, we're really seeing the fragmentation of politics in Europe and and the potential implications that that might have on the performance of democracy over time. So just as we wrap up, maybe one last question, because I would feel remiss of not having the opportunity to ask you. Can you talk about what you see is happening with political parties and particularly with social democracy? What is driving this fragmentation?
So, I mean, that's also, an incredibly complicated question and wrapped up with not only sort of the problems of democracy in general in places like Europe, but also the rise of populism in particular. So, I mean, we began to see already at the end of the 20th century the beginnings of what political scientists called de-alignment, that is to say a sort of weakening of party loyalties in Europe, which were historically much stronger than they were in the United States, and a willingness of voters to kind of, you know, flip around among elections in the way that they didn't do for the decades after the Second World War. And that trend really accelerated at the end of the 19th and particular at the beginning of the 21st century, to the point where, you know, in the past, in most, not all, but most West European countries, the sort of norm was that you had, you know, rotating coalitions made up of a large center-left party or a large center-right party with, you know, some smaller parties allied with them. And this gave these systems a certain degree of stability, right, because these governments were able to pass legislation because they had majorities in parliament that were relatively cohesive. And because they were anchored by center-left or center-right parties, they were relatively moderate. That is to say, they agreed on the sort of rules of the game as well as on the broad parameters of politics. They differed, of course, in important ways, you know, more taxation, less taxation, more welfare state, less welfare state, more immigration, less immigration. But the general, there was a general what you might call sort of pull towards the center. As that has broken apart, you've seen all sorts of problems. The most obvious is it's very hard in most West European countries now to actually form majority coalitions. We see this all the time. Spain is probably headed towards another election, despite the fact that the socialists improved their vote share, simply because they can't put together a majority. Now, this, again, it creates problems. People get frustrated. Policies don't get passed. Problems don't get solved. And it gives parties at the extreme not only greater power, but that frustration often drives people, you know, into the hands of populists because they feel like, again, the system is not working for them in whatever, you know, on whatever particular issues or concerns that they have. I would highlight, as you mentioned, Andrea, the particular importance of center-left parties here, not only because their collapse has been even more significant than that of the center-right, but because historically, or at least, you know, during the decades after the Second World War, center-left parties performed a very important function in West European party systems, right? Which is to say they were the place where those who were disadvantaged, disaffected, who felt that the system wasn't necessarily working for them, that was their home. And these parties after the Second World War took up the mantle of kind of defending those people, championing those people, but doing so now firmly anchored within the democratic rules of the game. And as those parties kind of lost their hold over their electorates in the late 20th and early 21st century for a whole variety of reasons that would take another podcast to discuss, you know, a lot of the, again, some of the voters who would historically have voted for them, particularly workers and the low educated, migrated elsewhere. But again, it gave rise to all of these, or it accelerated or contributed to all of these other trends, which is to say, again, in particular, more extreme parties on the left and the right, more floating voters, and, you know, no longer a kind of mainstream, so to speak, political option that promised not just change, but to protect society's least advantage, but to do so fully committed to the rules of the game. So again, I think populism has a lot of causes, and it's hard to disentangle from, again, some of these larger political trends, as well as the ones we talked about a little earlier, economic, social, blah, blah, blah.
Well, I feel like we could talk all afternoon. And I know Jim asked the really important question about what to do. And I'll just highlight that CNAS, and Sherry has been a part of this, is working on a project to try to identify a toolkit for kind of competing responsibly and countering the most illiberal forms of populism in Europe. So we'll highlight that. And for those of you who are interested in reading more of Sherry's work, she's done so much other work. Her book is fantastic. It's Democracy and Dictatorship in Europe. She just recently has another piece out in the Journal of Democracy. She's written a lot on technocracy. So please check out more of her work. And Sherry, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Yeah, thank you. It was great.
It was my pleasure. Thank you guys so much.